Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Often when we talk about our founding, we say that racism is the original sin, slavery is the original sin, and that is often taken to mean the things white people did to Black people, the things white people did to Native American people is the original sin. Therefore, the implication is that therefore white Americans are the original sinners and they must atone for what their people did. And I said, no, that's not it. The original sin is that we are a nation that was founded on the idea that we were all created equal with these unalienable rights, and then we enslaved people. And so race was, of course, central to who was a slave and who wasn't. But the idea that a nation founded on such an idea would enslave people was the actual problem with the founding at the founding of our country.
Happy Thursday, everyone. I hope you are having a great mid-August period. As you all know, Sagar is out in Paris right now having a really great vacation. Go check his Instagram for some really interesting pictures from the battlefields of World War I. Lots of good stuff there. I'm definitely really jealous. I wish I'd taken a vacation. But back at home, the show, as I said before, must go on. So I've brought a really interesting guest today, Dr. Theodore Johnson. I've wanted to do an episode on race for a long time, but as Sagar and I talked about it, we wanted to have the conversation in a very specific way with a very specific type of person, aka someone who wasn't going to be necessarily an activist on either end of the approach of it, because as you all know, we are really not down for the culture war here. And if we're going to discuss a hot button issue like race, we're going to want to do it with someone who's capable of having a nuanced conversation that's going to help people on either side of the realignment audience really think about things a little deeper in a different way. And Ted is just the right person to have this conversation with. He served in the Navy, retiring as a commander. He was a White House fellow during the Obama administration. He's a senior fellow and leader of the fellows program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. And he's done some really interesting writing on race and justice issues, but in a way that is kind of counterintuitive and really speaks to what we're trying to do here at The Realignment. He's the type of person, as we discussed at the start of the episode, who has published at National Review, but also a little bit later published at the New York Times Magazine. So he's really capturing the need to speak to audiences in different ways and oftentimes surprise people with what they aren't necessarily ready to hear. And there's plenty of that in this episode. So his new book is called When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America. I've really enjoyed it. I'm actually listening to the audiobook version right now. He did the narration himself and it's really, really good. So I recommend that you go to our bookshop and purchase the hard cover book there, or if you are an Audible first person like me, you could go to Audible and actually purchase the audiobook there. As you all know, it's always great to support authors, especially during our weird COVID time where no one exactly is going out and barnstorming for book sales. Like I said, it's the middle of summer. Normally we'd just take a break, but I'm having a lot of fun here. So we're putting the Substack on pause for another week or so, and we're just going to keep doing more episodes like this. Sagar will be back next week, but we will just have lots of great stuff to come in between and after that. Of course, before we go in, remember to check out the Realignment Conference in Miami on October 22nd. Everything's available in the show notes. And a huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. Ted Johnson, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
We are covering the topic of race, which is obviously contentious, but obviously incredibly overcrowded. There have been a million different books on this issue area, so it's been difficult to find the exact person to have the conversation with. But we were just talking before we started the episode, and I feel you really captured why I feel the project you're undergoing with your work, with your other writing that we'll reference in the show notes where we get to this. So what were you aiming to do when you started writing this book and this general idea?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems this country has with talking about racism right now is that we're not talking to each other about it. We're talking to other people who are like us about it. And so we sort of get in our little chambers and talk to folks about it and put those views out in the world. And so as we were saying before the start, you know, last summer, right after George Floyd's murder, I write a 5,000 word article for the National Review saying why this is a problem. And then just a couple of months later, I write 5,000 words for the New York Times Magazine explaining how racism leads Black voters to support one party over another in large quantities. And who else is writing for the National Review audience about racism and for the New York Times Magazine audience about racism within weeks of each other? And there's not a lot of folks. That's what I hope to do with this book, was to bring people who are not talking about racism with one another, but are having conversations about racism into the same arena, into the same room, and present a set of arguments, a set of ideas that they will both agree with some and argue with others, but have the conversation in the room together. And to me, if I could achieve that with this book, which was a tall order, I think I would have at least accomplished what I set out to do, at least the primary thing I set out to do.
Yeah, let's start with the uncomfortable part, because my biggest frustration in any mainstream conversation about race, especially in, let's assume, mostly center left, like mainstream institutions, they'll say things like, let's have a really uncomfortable conversation about race. And then it turns out the uncomfortable thing are things that are pretty straightforward if you're either a Democrat or a Republican. I've never actually heard a truly uncomfortable conversation in most of these places. So when you're writing for these two really bifurcated audiences, National Review, the New York Times, what is something uncomfortable that you said to the National Review audience? And then what is something uncomfortable you said to the New York Times audience? Let's start with National Review.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think for the National Review audience, I basically told them that white Americans have an easier go in this country than Black folks. I basically said white privilege is a thing, but I never used those words. What I said was, we have a nation that is structured in a particular way that advantages some more than others. And the problem we've had since our inception is that we've not done enough to address that gap between experiences. And that is the genesis of the original sin of our country. Often when we talk about our founding, we say that racism is the original sin, slavery is the original sin, and that is often taken to mean the things white people did to Black people, the things white people did to Native American people is the original sin. Therefore, the implication is that therefore white Americans are the original sinners, and they must atone for what their people did. And I said, no, that's not it. The original sin is that we are a nation that was founded on the idea that we were all created equal with these unalienable rights, and then we enslaved people. And so race was, of course, central to who was a slave and who wasn't. But the idea that a nation founded on such an idea would enslave people was the actual problem with the founding, at the founding of our country. And so because of that original decision, then some groups have had an easier go of it in America than others. No one has had a truly easy go for 245 years we've been around. Everyone has had their set of struggles. Everyone has had to work hard, rely on their talents and ingenuities, et cetera. So I'm not saying that this country's been gift wrapped to one group while it's been withheld from others, but I am saying that the difficulty is different, and the experiences are different. Our histories are intertwined, but different. And I think that was an uncomfortable thing said in a way that allowed people to shed the personal discomfort they may have felt in other arenas and accepted a sort of fundamental truth of our founding that doesn't victimize one group and turn the other into the evildoer. On the New York Magazine side, I basically said that, or the New York Times Magazine, that the parties aren't really interested in what happens to us, the public generally, and certainly not to those at the bottom end of society. We cast Republican parties, and by we, I mean the sort of general thinking about the public. The Republican Party is the party that's anti-civil rights, sort of wants to appeal to its white conservative base in order to hold on to political power. The Democratic Party is the one that plays identity politics. They want to exploit group identities in order to improve their electoral power. And what I try to show in this essay is both parties have exploited racial hierarchy because it was in their interest to do so to win political power, period. And that the reason
we
see-
And quick thing, do you mean in the present day?
No, forever. Okay. Ever since we've been created. When Black men first got the right to vote after the 15th Amendment, the vast majority of them voted for the party of Lincoln, for Republicans. And they continued to do so until they were disenfranchised throughout the South during the Redeemer and the sort of the Jim Crow era. And then when they moved in great migrations up to the Midwest and to the Northeast, many of them still, to the extent they could vote, voted Republican until those votes were contested because Northern Democrats recognized the power to be found in this new bloc. Then, you know, we could talk about all the reasons why, but by the 60s, the transformation was pretty complete. And then black folks voted, you know, 96% for Lyndon Johnson in 64 and you know, over 80% for the Democrat in 68. So we have black Americans have always voted in this lopsided manner, except for about one and a half, two decades in the 30s, 40s and 50s.
As the parties were transitioning.
As the parties transitioned on their position on civil rights. And so black folks have always voted against the party that was anti-civil rights or that they perceived to be less progressive on civil rights and always for the party that they felt would do things to advance civil rights protections. And the parties were just sort of pawns in this game of determining who supports us and who doesn't. And I think that was uncomfortable for a lot of progressive and liberals to hear that that their appeals are basically because of political interests in order to win electoral power and not because they have this deep-seated moral commitment to rectifying wrongs from the past.
So that's a bit of an assumption. Why do you, isn't it possible to do both? Isn't it possible that,
absolutely.
So I'm going to play a left member of the audience and just say, hey, I want to win political power because I want to defeat racism. And therefore, I care about racism. So what's your response to that?
My response is, that's great. Give me the five things that will do the most to reduce racism in the United States or the impacts, the effects of racism in the United States. Whatever those five things are, look at what Joe Biden and Barack Obama have done on those five issues over the last, you know, 12, 13 years. And you will find that they took pragmatic approaches to these questions that allowed them to move the ball down the field incrementally, but do so in a way that where they didn't have to pay steep political penalties for doing so. If you want to address structural racism at its root in this country, there's not a pragmatic way to do that. There's not a politically advantageous way to do that. Because as soon as you say this community has been harmed, so now we're going to craft public policy to help them recover from that harm, that gets weaponized by the other side that says, look what they're giving out to these folks just because of the color of their skin. It's unconstitutional, it's un-American, it's unpatriotic. And then they end up paying, the party ends up paying a price for doing something that they feel morally is the correct thing to do. And I mean, I don't mean to monopolize the time here, but we don't have to guess about this. Like last summer, we had the opportunity to do police reform, criminal justice reform. Vast majorities of Americans want it. We don't have it. We've had the opportunity to do gun reform, a gun policy reform. Vast amounts of Americans want some things like background investigations, et cetera. And it hasn't really happened. And it's because the system has not been responsive to the will of the people because it's too easy to hold on to power by exploiting the divisions in the public. And then government doesn't have to be responsive to any of us in the process. And frankly, it's this quandary that's at the center of the book.
See, I want to quibble with a couple of things you said there. Let's start. And once again, this is your show, so feel free to monopolize as much as you want. That's kind of the point of the format. But first thing, I'm interested in how you think about criminal justice reform and just the broader conversation about policing in America after last summer, because I think it's very hard to look at the summer of 2021 and think that politicians, the media, et cetera, had an accurate perception of how people actually felt around these policies. So I think it's easy to say, yes, there was a consensus around the idea that we had to reform policing in America right after George Floyd's death. Like there was this very specific, very strange moment there. But when it got into the actual nitty-gritty details, I get the sense you're kind of not attacking pragmatism, but you're pointing out the failures of pragmatism. But what I would suggest is actually what you describe as pragmatism, I just describe as reality. And the reality is, look at the New York City mayoral race. Black folks, especially like working class Black folks, opinions on a variety of these issues are actually very complicated. Upper middle class white people's views on these issues are actually really complicated. And I think just us going by, we found this poll that said that 66% of people think X, Y, and Z doesn't really help us understand. So I think the question I'll ask you, and please respond to my critique, but the actual question I could frame around is, how do we actually know what people think about these issues when they are so fraught and we don't really have a direct way of actually analyzing and thinking about it?
Yeah, so it's a tough question. And you're right that we could all cite polls that show the thing we believe is what the public believes and sort of make that claim. But here's what I'll say. Tim Scott produced a criminal justice reform or a police reform bill after George Floyd's murder. And the Democrats in the House, Pelosi and gang produced such a bill. And the main difference between the two was the question of qualified immunity. But aside from that question, much of what was in both bills in terms of banning certain moves, recording statistics, so you know the amount of shootings and misconduct, et cetera, that was kind of common between the two of them. And yet nothing happens because the conversation gets diverted by a politics of division that says qualified immunity is the thing we must resolve before we do anything, or defund the police is a destructive mantra that must be disavowed before we'll be willing to work with someone on the other side. And so now we have a system that where 80% of what's in both parties want, what's in their bills, are aligned, and we get 0% of those things because it is more politically advantageous to find the areas of disagreement and polarize the public, because that's what gets people fired up and ready to vote and support their side and vote out the other team. And so, and this is what I mean by the way race has been used, it has been weaponized to keep us separated, so that instead of government delivering on 80% of the things it agrees with, and those politicians didn't come up with that 80% on their own. That is feedback from activists, from nonprofits, from their public, from constituents calling in. We don't get that 80% because it is, again, more politically advantageous to find the 20% difference and then divide us along those lines. So I don't mean to sort of throw blows at pragmatism, because I believe there is a tremendous value in pragmatism. But when it's pragmatism for the sake of political expediency, then going back to the previous set of questions, you have to wonder either side's commitment to racial equality instead of being committed to sort of the political expedience that will allow them to maintain their seats of power.
So here's the question I'd have then. Well, a very obvious question. Can you explain qualified immunity to the audience? I think everyone gets defund the police. What was the qualified immunity debate about?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it's about whether or not agents of the state, in this case, law enforcement officers, can be sued civilly or by members of the public who believe their rights have been infringed upon. Qualified immunity gives agents of the state with certain responsibilities immunity from certain types of lawsuits and being charged with wrongdoing, or not criminal, but certainly civil. And in this way, there's kind of a shield when people say, I've been mistreated by the police, and they don't have a means to hold the policemen accountable for what they've done. So qualified immunity is the shield that prevents this. Many would say, and I I'm retired military, so I get it. There is, if you want a society that tells people you need to go into the line of fire, into dangerous situations every day, and make split second judgment calls on what to do to protect the public. And if you make a wrong, so we recognize that. If you make the wrong decision, we're going to give you some grace because of the extraordinary set of circumstances you voluntarily throw yourself into every day. And then there's the other side that says, well, that's fine, but if it's me who's killed because you've extended that grace, do I or does my family not have a way to address those wrongs, even if it was deemed a justified killing? Qualified immunity says, this is the cost of securing the public. And those that say qualified immunity is outdated says, no one should be held. No one should be beyond the reach of being held accountable for their actions.
And where do you come down on the topic?
Yeah, I'm, you know, so being the ultimate pragmatist.
And by the way, you don't have to give me a perfect, because here's what I want to be very precise when I was asking that question. Because like you said, there's nuance. You're retired military. I'm not asking for you to give me a crossfire style, like, yes, no. Right. Just what is your perspective on the topic?
Yeah, my thing is there is probably a better way to implement. And I think this is probably my response to the vast majority of public policy questions out there. A lot of times the things that we implement in our society aren't inherently bad, aren't inherently racist, aren't inherently sexist, but upon implementation by people not thinking about these issues at the forefront, the outcomes tend to produce these very racially or gender disparate kind of outcomes. So on qualified immunity, instead of saying it's good or it's bad, I would say, how is it enforced? When is it enforced? Who falls under the umbrella and when? You know, are we finding that it's mostly junior officers are sort of left out and senior officers aren't, or that the union is the one that's pushing this, but most, frontline police officers are actually okay with some relaxing of the immunity. And so I would say, there's probably some middle ground there that will allow those that think it's terrible to feel more comfortable with it being in place. And those that think it's absolutely necessary to feel comfortable that it does what it's set out to do, which is to give these folks who are doing a dangerous job some sense of comfort that they won't be penalized for every decision they make, while also recognizing that if they do make an egregious error or an error that they were trained not to make and have done it once or repeatedly, that there is a price to pay for making bad decisions.
I want to ask you about the other part of this polarization issue through the lens of defund the police, which you just brought up. But I want to shout out something you said at the start of the episode, where you specifically talked about how when you're running in National Review, you didn't use the term privilege because, and everyone on the right side of the audience is going to get this, that is it's a very charged term in the audience you're actually speaking to. And I think whether or not people agree or disagree with your take in the article, I think it's very admirable that you were making a big effort to say, hey, what language am I using when I'm attempting to communicate the point that I'm trying to make? And my frustration with defund the police is top line. It's not just, there's the obvious, like, this is bad marketing. I think that's rather obvious. I think there's a reason why it's been disowned by basically everybody. But I also have a problem with it at a political theory level, because it's almost basically saying that because of the moral weight of my cause, I have the right and the ability to basically say whatever I want and not try to meet people halfway. So that's just my take on it. I would just love to hear the politics of it, the policy of it. And, you wrote this back in, June, July. It's been a year. Just what has the journey been surveying and writing about this issue so far?
Yeah. So I used to be a speechwriter when I was in the military. So I've always paid particular attention to language. Sometimes I get it right, sometimes I don't. The one thing I don't do, though, is avoid particular words, but not the ugly truths that they may reveal, or the positive, the beauty that they may reveal. When I'm talking to those on the far left about structural racism, I don't talk tons about the promise of America and patriotism, because it's not because they're not patriotic. It's not because they don't love their country. Yeah, but it's because patriotism has been hijacked to mean something that doesn't mean a multiracial egalitarian society. And I don't use white privilege and those sorts of things with conservative audiences, not because I don't recognize that different groups have different experiences in our country, but because what am I accomplishing by using this term that is shown to be completely divisive? So here's what I would say about this choice that I'm making. I think I'm going to sort of devolve into binaries here, but there are kind of like two kinds of people looking to change the world. One kind is the truth teller. That's what I call them. These are your activists, the sort of unbending folks. These are the folks that say the right thing to do is X. The right thing to do is to defund police departments and redirect that money to social services so that police aren't responding to every single crisis that happens in a community and come with guns blazing, and especially in communities of color, marginalized communities, et cetera, et cetera. And if you say, I hear what you're saying, but how about we just ban this chokehold? We both agree on that. Let's just do that. The truth teller will say, I'm glad you think incrementalism is good politics. I'm not interested in that. There is a moral harm happening. And if I compromise on this moral harm, I am basically allowing that harm to continue for some segment of people that aren't included in our incremental solution. And that's unacceptable. And then on the other hand, you have the bridge builders who will be acceptable to incrementalism. They will say, I see what the truth tellers are saying, and I actually agree with what they're saying on the right or the left. And I see the North Star they've planted in the sky that tells us where we need to get to if we really want to fulfill the promise of America. But we're not going to get there tomorrow. But if we can do something that's going to make the world a little bit safer, this community a little bit safer, people a little bit more prosperous, release, you know, 1,000 people from prison instead of, 100,000, I think that that is worth it. And I'm willing to make the political concessions, the public policy compromises, negotiations, et cetera, to do this little bit of good with the understanding that we're going to leave some people still on the cutting room floor. And so I think of myself as a bridge builder who tries to get the two sets of truth tellers on opposite ends of the spectrum to recognize that they most of what they want is primarily the same. And they may have differences of how to get there, and they may have differences on the impetus for why this thing is an issue. But if we can agree on 25% of something, let's do that and see what kind of world we create when we do that, not just in policy outcomes, but now we have this established relationship where we've worked together to accomplish something positive. And then we can bicker about the 75%, but that will be a different conversation than this sort of good versus evil team sports approach to partisan politics.
Well, here's an interesting question then. What, because I'm struggling with this mentally, what is that 25% that truth tellers on the left and truth tellers on the right actually agree on? Because that's what I'm struggling. Because especially in the area of race, like what is that 25%? Because I'm skeptical in that specific space.
Yeah. And so this takes us back to first principles, because I think that's where we are. We're not ready for advanced conversations about education policy or criminal justice policy, because we don't trust one another. We don't operate from the same set of facts. And there is an actual view that the poles of both sides are trying to create a very different country. We're not even working towards the creation of the same thing anymore. So for me, that 25% is a reinvestment in the American civil religion. And this is not some genius idea I came up with. This is as old as Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Robert Bella and the sociologist from Berkeley in the 60s. Wrote this really great article that talks about civil religion. And what this basically is, it's just sort of it's a recognition that there is a way to be American, that there is there's a way to exercise your desire for civic belonging. So in the same ways religions have canon and sacred texts and rituals and observances, if you look at American life from the Constitution, the Declaration, Independence Day, Memorial Day, Lincoln and Washington and Martin Luther King, we have all the markings of what religions typically have, but the belief system isn't based around some deity and a set of disciples and prophets, et cetera. The belief system is based on the first parts of the Declaration, that we are all created equal, that we have these unalienable rights. Among these include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that government derives its power from the consent of the governed. I think 80% of Americans, 90% of Americans agree, I believe that to be true. I believe that our country should be based on that idea. I think if you take it the next step and talk about race, if you say, okay, you believe this, do you believe that every race, every ethnicity should have equal claim, equal access, and equal protections to all of these things? The vast majority of Americans would say, absolutely. And then, so now we're on the same page. And then the question is, for those who didn't have access to these things and have just been recently brought into this, do you think the nation state should do something to address the harms that was done to this group when they were excluded from the promise that we all agree should be the foundation of this country? And at that point, you get people to say, well, what do you mean? And that's when we start to see the paths diverge. Some would say, well, we've already done that work. I mean, people have said the Civil War, the million casualties in the Civil War, that was reparations. Everyone was equal after that point. So let's, sure, we didn't get it right, but let's just sort of dust our, the dirt off our hands and say, we're equal now. Let's go forward and behave that way. And it's just not that simple. So I think that's the 20-25% is going back to first principles and grounding us all in the, this, the only idea that connects us. Nothing else unites us except for this idea of what our constitutional democracy is, was founded on and stands for.
What's a good pivot to operationalizing everything you're saying through specific policy issues? So the immediate thing that comes to mind, and it's probably on most listeners' minds, especially because you said the word, is reparations. I'll ask this question on two different levels. Take them in whatever order you want. The first question is, how do you conceive of reparations? So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that question. So when I think of reparations, I think of there are reparations that are offered to people who literally experienced what the harm was. So I get frustrated when people who are trying to have the conversation about reparations talk about how Germany offered reparations to Holocaust survivors, because I'm like, well, those are the literal persons right. who you literally wronged. And that's why 40 acres and a mule is actually different than the reparations conversation we're having today. Because that is expropriating wealth and resources from people who actually committed a wrong and a direct crime. So I think the usage of those two examples as a means of having the reparations conversation is very frustrating for me, because I don't think it actually gets at where the actual, once you move beyond that 20%, the disagreements actually come about. So just how do you think about the reparations issue itself? Maybe you totally disagree. That's obviously welcome.
So here's what I think. The first thing is, it goes back to the point I was making about, you know, if you're progressive and believe racism is a problem, why aren't you doing enough? Or, you know, that part of the conversation. This is a good example. If the H.R. 40, this bill to study reparations, has been presented at every Congress for decades now, and has never gotten, I think maybe it just got out of the House, but of course it's not going anywhere. I think I wrote in Politico about this a few years ago. You don't actually need to pass legislation to do a study. Presidents do this all the time. Lyndon Johnson did it. Truman did it on civil rights. Johnson did it on civil rights. And so if this was really something that the Democratic Party, for example, was committed to doing, to studying reparations, to see the harms, try to chronicle the harms, try to evaluate, monetize, whatever the right word is, then they would just, the president would say, I am establishing this commission to do this. But he hasn't, because it's not politically advantageous to do it. It's a divisive issue. And so you leave it at the feet of Congress, and you know that it's not going to go anywhere in Congress. So that's the first part of reparations. If we were a nation serious about it, it would have already happened.
I want to spend a second here then. I almost feel as if you're being a little bad faith towards, let's just say, the mainstream of older political leaders in the Democratic Party. Jim Clyburn just doesn't support reparations. That's his actual. So he isn't saying, oh, I would pass this, but it's really going to tick off the moderate suburban base we need to hold the House in 2022. He's just straight up says, no, I just don't support this policy. So I just want to, I think it actually is important to note that.
So agreed. And the study doesn't actually implement reparations at all. And so a president, so again, if the president, or in this example, if the president is the leader of a party, and this party says, there's nothing more important for us and our country than to dismantle structural racism, and we believe that reparations should be a consideration, then they wouldn't wait for Congress. This executive, this party, wouldn't wait for Congress to act before they acted on it, if it was that morally, such a moral demand from the party, from those adherents. Now, it doesn't mean that all of Democrats or all partisans subscribe that to the kind of reparations that have been talked about publicly, which is give Black people $10 trillion. and that will account for all the harms that were done to them during slavery and Jim Crow. Clyburn doesn't agree with that. And not just Clyburn, there's probably lots of folks in the CBC who wouldn't agree that this is the number and this is the way it should be distributed, you know, cash or checks or et cetera. So the study is different from actual distribution of resources. So that's one distinction. I only brought that up front to talk about a policy or an action that a party could take that they believe would dismantle structural racism that it hasn't taken because doing so would be politically destructive or harmful. So that's just the first part of the answer. On the second part, and I guess I'm kind of like going to your question, like I went around the left end on that one, I'll go around the right end on this one. Let's say we did reparations tomorrow. Based on how our society currently operates, the day after reparations checks are distributed, you would find the most exploitive financial vehicles the world has ever seen targeting Black Americans who have newfound wealth. You know, these checks that are supposed to bring Black households up to the level of white households, you know, $100,000 each if we were to close the gap. That doesn't mean the nation values us more. That just means we've closed the wealth gap. There is a line of thinking that says you close the wealth gap, this is a nation that's responsive to money, and therefore those with wealth will now have more power. But when everyone has wealth, then we find other ways to divide ourselves. We find other ways to implement or to act on hierarchies because we're a society. This is what happens. And those people who are valued less but have the same wealth will be the people who are targeted to in order to redistribute the wealth that was redistributed to them. So if we were to do reparations, it doesn't heal society tomorrow. It doesn't make voting rights or voter suppression no longer a thing. It doesn't make, if you think that Black folks with this wealth from reparations moving into predominantly rich white neighborhoods will be accepted and welcomed with open arms, then that just belies everything history has told us about how society operates, or at least our society. So reparations may be a way to address the wealth gap, but our social issues, the issues in our society, run much deeper than the household household wealth. This is a question of like inherent value, of belongingness, of like civic friendship and solidarity. And reparations doesn't do that in and of itself. The last thing I'll say on this point, though, is that the symbology of reparations is really important. And it may not need to be cash reparations. I wrote a piece 6 years ago that says maybe another way to do reparations is to weight the votes of Black Americans. And that way, the only way they get to exercise their you know, I said we used to be 3/5 of a person for purposes of the census, give our votes 5/3 weight for like 6 presidential cycles. And that could be a kind of reparations. But the point there wasn't to argue for that system, but to say there are other ways to try to create a society where racial equality is the objective.
You're throwing out very interesting ideas, which is all I actually care about. So I don't want to I want to be very precise when I say this, because audience members are screaming at me. I could hear them already. I'm not going to hold you to account to the 5/3, you know, to the weighing votes more idea, because I don't want to get into a tactical debate. But what I do want to say is that issue, the issue of reparations, the biggest concern I have is just the idea of it furthering white identity politics in the sense that you very specifically are – you were just very directly preferencing one group over other groups in a very precarious moment in our country's history. So it's not as if it's, once again, it's not 1865. So it's not 40 acres and a mule. It's not like Germany was forced to do with Holocaust survivors. It's not let's literally pay these people who were enslaved. This is almost centuries after the fact, we would live in an America where, let's say hypothetically, people got checks operationally for being Black. And people who were white, which as we all know is a very complicated thing, right? As of 80, 70, even 60 years ago, Jews were not white, Italians were not white, Catholics, Eastern Europeans, Mediterraneans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, automatically. It just seems like if the actual objective is solidarity. And we'll get to this in a bit, because that's actually what I think the core of your book is arguing as an objective for the country. It seems like in an America that's growing increasingly racially diverse, you are just lighting everything on fire, no matter whether it's checks, Wade votes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So can you just talk, but at the same time, to argue against myself, I also don't want to be overly pragmatic and say that we only do things because they maintain pure social balance for social balance's sake, because it'd be very easy for you to come up with literally 50 different examples of, well, was it really the most advantageous time to pass the civil rights legislation at that exact moment, Marshall? That's obviously true. So can you just talk more about the phenomenon of, like, what does it look like to engage in racial preferences when the country itself is in this very destabilizing moment?
So a couple of things. The first is sort of on this reparations point is that the act of it has a social and a political value that is helpful to creating the kind of multiracial solidarity I think we need. Apologies matter. The recognition of a state wrong and an attempt to remedy that wrong, that acknowledgement matters. When, you know, the Black men that were subjected to the Tuskegee syphilis experiment by, you know, being having treatment withheld from them so scientists could watch them die from syphilis, Clinton gave a formal national apology to that experiment that went from 1932 to 1972 and wasn't hit. I mean, doctors were talking about it at medical conferences. And he also said the United States will pay for all of the medical bills of the people who are still alive, who are part of the experiment, and their descendants and their family members, their spouses, but their children and grandchildren, because these men had something that they could pass on that could lead to, you know, blindness, et cetera. And so now you have people who are a generation or two removed from the harmful act, but who have continued to be exposed to harm because of that act. We have actually given reparations in the last 30 years to those folks. The reason it wasn't that big of a deal is because paying for someone's medical insurance in this grand scheme of America's economy, you know, for the dozen or so men that were alive is not that big of a deal. We paid reparations to the families of Japanese Americans that were interned during World War II. Reagan did that, you know, Reagan paid reparations. But it wasn't just to the people that were incarcerated, but to families. So the idea that you have to be directly subjected to the harm in order to qualify doesn't fully recognize the harm of like the way harm lasts longer than just the people. But I take your point that
quick question on this. I hate to interrupt, but it's just actually kind of, it's important. The two cases that you listed are not cases that threaten the social stability of the country. That's what I'm kind of getting at, right?
Yes,
so,
exactly.
So that's
the point. Exactly. Right. So this gets back to the pragmatism point, or doing things that are politically expedient, not because you do things not because they're morally correct, but you do it because you don't really pay a political price for doing so. Reagan paid no price. Clinton paid no price. And in fact, I would argue in the 80s, when Americans were worried about Japan's economy, this was a kind of a measure that would say we're not hostile to the Japanese. And Clinton, who, you know, his presidency needed Black folks to show up. This was a sort of a measure that says, I recognize that I'm here because of that. So you're right. The fact that they weren't destabilizing made them acceptable measures to take. And that goes back to my original point about the parties being interested in these things that are politically feasible and not necessarily morally moral requirements. So let's think about reparations that could be destabilizing. The first thing I would say is that the messaging of it is critically important. If you are telling white people that they have benefited in this society since the nation's inception and Black people haven't, therefore we're going to help Black people catch up, then of course you're going to have something divided, because it sounds like you're giving things to Black people and it's white people's fault. If you say the nation committed a series of bad policy decisions that dehumanized people, actual people in our country, for decades, centuries, And now we're trying to fix that harm. I think more people would say, I could see that. And then they would say, but Irish immigrants were harmed. My grandparents came here and they were called all kinds of slurs and they were beaten and denied jobs, et cetera. So when do we get Irish American reparations? And when do Native Americans get their reparations? And when do Italian Americans and Chinese immigrants get their reparations? And what Black Americans would say, of course, is that's not, you know, we're fighting our battle, you fight your battle. It says to say nothing of your claim, but that the fight for reparations for the harms of slavery and or Jim Crow is a specific request that's different from maybe legitimate requests from other groups. But it's divisive because, like you said, it looks like you're giving one group preference over others who also have rightful claims that the state has harmed them. And so the way forward on this, I think, is to deprioritize the means and start talking about tailoring policy to help people finally attain that level playing field that, again, back to first principles, we all agree we should be operating from. And so, you know, even folks like Charles Murray talks lots about group differences in IQ, group differences in violent crime. Well, let's talk about group differences across a range of socioeconomic factors. And if we see that Black Americans are lagging in these indicators, then good public policy would say, the cause of these disparities are X, Y, and Z. The way to address X, Y, and Z is to do A, B, and C in public policy. So let's do that for this group. Oh, and look at these poor white folks in the Appalachian Mountains. Well, the cause of their poverty and their educational disparity and income disparity, et cetera, is X, Y, and Z. So is DEF. That's different from what is causing poverty in inner city Baltimore. So let's craft public policy to ensure those families, those children, have the opportunity to participate in America on a level playing field. That, to me, is race conscious policy that doesn't look like, you know, social safety net giveaways to a group of people because of their race. Instead, it's tailored public policy that addresses people's history, their experiences, and their specific challenges in order to bring them into this egalitarian society we're trying to create. And instead of leaving them behind with colorblind policy that may not meet the needs of people, no matter their race or ethnicity or class.
Yeah, we're two immediate things here, because I'm really interested in what you have to say about this. So one, the side of you who was a White House fellow and, you know, obviously understands how the policy process worked. My DC side of me says, well, Ted, you and I both know the way DC works is not, okay, we are going to sit down and we're going to have our African-American policy. And then next week, it's on the calendar, we're going to do our Appalachian J.D. Vance hillbilly elegy policy. And then after that, we're going to, like, that's not how it actually works. So I'm not trying to be nitpicky on tactics, but what I'm trying to basically say is, can you actually help me understand at an idea level, not literal level, how this idea of addressing A, B, C, and D actually works when it seems to me, for example, let's say it's the Biden administration. If it's the Biden administration or Obama first term, Obama actually did not have the chance to do A, B, C, D, E, F, and all the way up to Z. He had one or two things to do.
Yeah.
And what I think someone who's skeptical would say is like, look, let's get real. I think the thing that would not be on the priority list would be down market Southern whites who have suffered X, Y, and Z thing. Democrats would choose Black people because Black people are the base of the Biden Obama Democratic Party. So can you just explain how you think about, or this is actually a better way, how can we get more to a system where actually it would be possible to do multiple things at once?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the question of public policy in a nation of 330 million people that are very different in a number of ways, but still cling to the same sort of national identity for the most part. It can't be top down. And big things you can do top down, you know, giving grants or big pots of money or saying, you know, racism is bad and unacceptable and those who do it will be you know, held accountable. But other things like tailored public policy that actually fixes problems have to be bottom up. So you're right. The Biden administration cannot come up with the policy for the hillbillies and then come up with a policy for the thugs. You know, like there's like these caricatures. You can't put them on a piece of paper and say, this is how I fix their problem. But what you can do is empower the people who are subject to the problems to solve them or to at least be a part of the solution. And, you know, this is not states' rights kind of talk. This is actually allowing policy to be responsive to people in all of the ways they show up in their communities and their families, et cetera, instead of policy being responsive to, you know, the things that drive elections or the ideas or the rhetoric that drives polarization and electoral outcomes. So this is one of those places where great ideas from Obama, from Biden, from Trump, Bush, you name it, they're not going to solve things because the federal government is not capable of that level of tailoring of public policy in the way that I described. Only communities can do that. And so, you know, I have these range of recommendations in the back of the book, but one of them is deliberative democracy. And it's the idea that people will take part in their governing, that they will not just elect representatives and then be subject to their governance or the kind of unresponsive governance that many of us see, but rather they will be part of the budgeting cycle. They will be part of determining, you know, zoning laws and where districts are formed, et cetera, instead of it having it dictated to them by ambitious politicians at the state or the federal level. The hard part about this, of course, is that it's impossible to align thousands of communities, hundreds of thousands of communities across the country. And so you end up with this uneven hodgepodge of laws and et cetera that are done well in one place and done horribly in other places that may exacerbate inequality in some ways. But if we do believe that states and localities are the laboratories of democracy, then the good ideas bubble up. And then it's a matter of, and something the federal government should be good at, is taking good ideas and then extrapolating and building out and building upon them so that more folks can leverage the advantage that has been realized from people taking control of their own destinies.
Well, something I'm curious about then, because I'm glad you brought up the state and local example, because I feel like over the past year, we've had a couple experiences of poorly thought out local implementations of some of these ideas of actually causing a lot of trouble. So, for example, in Oakland, I believe there was that experiment with a universal basic income that wasn't actually technically universal because basically the city received a grant from a foundation, so it wasn't taxpayer money. To be very precise, and this is how this gets complicated, it wasn't taxpayer money, but it was a grant to offer basically basic income just to African Americans. And from my perception as a New Yorker / Washingtonian, at the national level, this was not well received because, once again, messaging was terrible. It was confusing as to, wait, was this literal city saying, hey, we're going to literally preference these taxpayers over other taxpayers? That seemed to cause a lot of trouble. And the other area where you saw trouble is during the prioritization of vaccines during the early part, where there were states and localities made the decision, oh, we're going to prioritize giving vaccines to essential workers because those vaccines, and often explicitly. So, and these were not elected officials saying this, because elected officials, for a variety of reasons, because they have speechwriters such as yourself, don't say things this explicitly. But right. You had technocrats and public health bureaucracy saying, oh, yeah, the reason why we're not giving it to old people first is we're actually seeing that we have a concern about frontline workers who tend to be more black and brown. So we're just preferencing and making that decision that way, in a way that upon reflection seems a little confusing given a variety of issues. There's a whole other different podcast, but can you just comment on what happens? And once again, like, I don't know all the details about both those situations, so I'm not trying to make a super specific point, but more right. Just saying, like, what happens when you kind of have these hodgepodge of the policies that might miss something or might not get it right? I'm just curious how you think about that.
Yeah. That's how, like, incrementalism works. That's just how it goes. I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say like marijuana legalization or decriminalization now. In some cities, it's cool. Some states, it's cool. Federal government, it's still not. Now we have this hodgepodge of laws where you can buy marijuana legally in one state and be pulled over by federal agents in that state, be pulled over by state police in the next state, be pulled all over by sheriffs in like the bordering county for the very thing you bought legally. And usually when this happens, it's happened with voting, it's happened with same-sex marriage, then we recognize we cannot have a country with such unevenness. And then suits are filed, and then, you know, the Supreme Court or the federal government through Congress or the executive gets involved. But the only reason they got involved was because we created this hodgepodge of policy across the country. And so fighting for what you believe in your local area is good public policy, because even if it makes things uneven, that unevenness often forces action at the next level up that will at least standardize things, hopefully for the better. Sometimes it's been for the worse. So I don't think the fact that there might be some unevenness is a good enough reason to not do something. I think that what happened in Oakland was basically an experiment funded by a philanthropy, I believe, or something. And because people were saying, if you just give people who are living below the poverty line money, instead of giving them these, food stamp cards or WIC cards or, these cards that only can buy certain kinds of food, but not others. And you only can use it if you're looking for work or have a job. You take away all those restrictions and just give them money, that they will use the money responsibly and it will actually help lift them out of poverty. And that sounded like a great idea. But where's the data that says that's actually true? And so then you get someone to fund a UBI program for Black folks in Oakland.
And why does that? But this is what I don't understand at a political practicing level.
Yeah.
Why does it have to? Why do you literally have to put a line saying it's just for Black folks?
Yeah.
That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. So two things. The first is, there's multiple things. One, there's a political piece here. It's signaling to some extent. If you're in Oakland, Oakland has a not insignificant number of Black people there. And if you are the mayor at the time this program happens, you have things to point to, actionable, demonstrative things to say, this is what we did. And that is back to my point about political feasibility. The other part of this is sort of pulling out, saying, if you believe that Black Americans have had a harder go of achieving the American dream than some other groups, then the way to test it is to say, well, can we close the racial gap if we provide the group that's at the bottom of the gap these resources and use the group at the top of the gap as the control? And that's just good science to determine whether or not the gap closes or not. It's not good politics, but it's good social science. The other part of this, though, is it's not all unfounded. Over a century ago, W.E.B. Du Bois writes this book called The Philadelphia Negro, and his contention was the reason we see such these bouts of tuberculosis in poor Black communities is not because they're Black and unclean, because I went and looked at communities in Philadelphia that are Black, but that are middle class, that are upper class, and they don't have this issue with tuberculosis. So maybe it's not a function of Black people being Black or Black culture, but maybe it's a function of socioeconomic status. And so in this way, he was able to show through his studies on TB that actually socioeconomics mattered more to the Black health experience in Philadelphia than culture did or race. And so this is another way of showing how socioeconomic status can sometimes, if you improve one status, you can close gaps. So those kinds of experiments signal bad politics, but they can be signaled in a way that doesn't necessarily do that. The last thing I'll say on this, and I'm not a political strategist at all. I'm just a political scientist, basically, who looks at data and then makes some assumptions. If you signal this by talking about things like zip codes or people who are hardest hit based on some quality most Americans believe in, then and not something around like race, for example, you can still have outcomes that help one group of people more than others in order to close gaps without all the animus that comes along with specifically saying this is for Black people. So a great example of this could be, educational opportunity zones, something Tim Scott talks a lot about, but it could be almost any policy that requires federal governments or states to give localities money. Instead of rolling that money out and saying it is now available to all people who meet the following requirements and apply, you can say we are rolling this money out in a very strategic way. Communities that were hardest hit by coronavirus are going to be the first that we help, period. Just stop there. And it just so happens that many of those communities are Black and brown. If you signal we're helping Black and brown people first because they were hit hardest first, you are making a political appeal to a certain segment of the electorate that is also going to be weaponized against you by those who appeal to those on the other side of the electorate that weren't part of this appeal. But if you just say we are helping those who are hit hardest first, and as best we can tell, you know, these are the areas or the zip codes or whatever of those communities. And so relief is going, just like relief would go to communities hit by hurricanes or typhoons and not to the whole state, go where the damage is, fix it, and then allow the benefits of that to sort of filter out from that community or reach other communities later. And so in this way, by staggering on some other attribute that we value, like you know, the people's jobs or their work or et cetera, without bringing in the divisive piece, could create a more solidarity community, but you don't get to reap the political benefits of showing the voters who will vote for you before they vote for the other guy that you've prioritized their means. You kind of have to hope that they get it in the grand scheme of things. And people are too busy to get it by implication. They need the explicit appeal. And then we're back into division.
So two last questions here. I've kind of been implicitly coming at you from the center right. So I'll go far to the left and bring up what I feel is a more Democratic Socialists of America audience, who there's like, once again, a whole other episode about the weird Marxists have beef with identity politics argument. So I'll kind of come from that perspective and say, hey, you know, Ted, your point about how Black people have suffered in this country is really well taken. Your point about hillbillies and, you know, Irish people and all these different groups in America have really suffered. Well, that's because America for its entire existence has been a capitalist hellhole built upon this myth of meritocracy and bootstraps and all of the phrases we've all heard a lot. So do you know what we should just do instead? You know how we can help the Black white wealth gap? Let's have universal free college. Let's forgive student loan debt. Let's have universal basic income. You could even be like centrist and say you'd support that policy. Let's engage in a $1 trillion plus program of economic solidarity that would have the benefit of helping Black folks, helping hillbillies, and also help. And I'm not sure who these Irish people we keep talking about are. I know, but, you know, there's some corner of Boston we're referring to, but also help them. Because I just know that is what they are saying to everything you're saying. Like what is your response to that whole, you are choosing identity politics over class solidarity?
Yeah. Simply, I would say colorblind policy doesn't solve color conscious problems. And so if we just give people free college, then we'll close the racial gap in educational outcomes, or we'll close the racial gap in hiring or employment or income, et cetera. And our society doesn't work that way. However, we've tried to address the problems racism presents, racism finds a way to exploit the solution and perpetuate itself, maybe in a lesser form, but still exist. And so if socialism is your answer to capitalism, because getting rid of capitalism now fixes most of racism, I would say you've got it backwards, that racism is the problem. So let's fix that. And then whether we have a capitalistic society or not, is less of an issue, because most times the ills of capitalism have been wielded to pursue racial disparate outcomes, you know, intentionally, or class outcomes intentionally. So let's fix the race problem. The idea that you can't have racism exist in a socialistic society is just not borne out by the truth. Whenever a state has resources, then there will be a group that gets more access to those resources than other groups. And usually that line is traced along racial lines. And for a nation like ours, it can't help but be traced along racial lines unless we make specific appeals to addressing the racial aspect of these things. So, I would just generally say, if we think public policy is going to be the thing that solves our race issue, then we're mistaken. Public policy can make our race problems smaller. And it's an admirable endeavor. I work at an organization, we think about this all the time. But the root of our problem is that we value some people in our society more than others. And often those that are at the bottom end of that value proposition are people of color. And so if we were to address that, then when states don't pass voter suppression laws, and we don't have to have an argument about whether they're voter suppression laws or voter fraud laws or et cetera, because everyone is invested in this community that believes in universal suffrage and an inclusive and participatory democracy. And so now we don't have to battle over all these laws that give this group a little bit more access and this group a little bit easier access, because we're already there. We already believe that ease of access is the right thing to do. And so, I don't make a whole lot of friends, I think, in like saying racism is at the root of most of what ails us. But even in the book, I say, some folks say economic inequality is the problem. We solve that. We have a better nation. Some folks say, no, it's these illiberal tendencies and these demagogues that are exploiting them. If we fix this issue, and by through institutions and strengthening our systems and processes, we get a better country. And others will make, other arguments that sort of get around the race point by saying, if we do these things, racism kind of goes away because we solve these material things. And my thing is, we have a battle of character at the moment. Not even at the moment. It has been the question behind the American project, behind the American experiment is can a nation exist in a way that is multiracial, pluralistic, democratic, and large of over 300 million people? And no other nation has proven this to be true. This is what we're after. And material interests aren't going to be enough to keep such a large, diverse nation together. It's going to have to be the moral argument that that racial equality is at the root of our issues, and therefore is the key to solving much of what ails the country.
So last quick question. We started the conversation by talking about how voting patterns really matter, pragmatism, all those things. What does it mean that Trump increased, not by a huge amount, but what does it mean that Trump increased his voting share, especially of Black men? Like, what does it mean for this entire conversation?
Yeah. And so all I would say is that the increase Trump saw in 2020 still shows that the folks that were Black Republicans before Obama have not returned home in full yet, because Trump still did worse in 2020 than George Bush did in 2004, did worse than Reagan did in 84, in 84. Trump's, the last I saw, based on the Pew validated voter surveys, Trump got 8% of the Black vote in 2020 and 6%, 7% in 2016, which is different from what some of the early exits showed, but those smaller sample sizes, and we could go into the issues there. But the fact that he increased from 6 to 8 is not insignificant. And I think all it tells us is that the 1 in 10 Black folks that have always voted in against or on the other side of the other 9 in 10 Black folks has always been the case, certainly since the beginning of the last century. So it's unremarkable to me, frankly, that he was able to increase his share, mostly because the people that voted for him were usually people who didn't vote in the previous election. There are people who sat out the election in 16 and then, sort of came back into the electorate and were probably either conservative leaning or Republican voters before and just didn't feel like, they didn't like Trump if they were actual Republicans in 2016 or actual conservatives, and they didn't like Clinton, so they sat it out and he was able to bring some back in. And then they can point to things like, Trump advocated for making Juneteenth the national holiday in 2020. He could have done it before then, wasn't politically feasible, back to our earlier conversation. Mm-hmm. But his platinum plan for Black America, Juneteenth was going to be a national holiday. So Black folks who voted for Trump could point to things like that and say, it's not that the guy's racist. He may be, it may not be the most welcoming of presidents, but at least he's done stuff in terms of unemployment, et cetera, and they cite these statistics. So I don't think there's much there, frankly. I think a better candidate with a better message would have done far better with Black voters in 2020 than Trump did.
Well, that's a good way to end by deflating some part of the audience's hopes and dreams.
the Republican Party is on the wrong path with Black voters. He did do a little bit better with Hispanic voters that may hold more promise in certain states. But Black voters writ large, there's a lot of work to be done. And I don't think it's happenstance that suddenly Tim Scott is in the news a little bit more about 2024 as of late.
That's a great place to end it, like I said. So Ted, shout the book out. Any work you're doing, people here love books, so I just would love for you to do that.
Yeah, please. Yeah. So my new book, When the Stars Begin to Fall, Overcoming Racism and Renewing the Promise of America, is out now. It's been out for about 7 weeks now. Lots of engagement, especially on the center right, which is somewhat surprising. I thought those on the left would engage it and interrogate it a little bit more. I'm still hoping for that. I'm doing a bunch of university stuff, but I've been calling it the book that talks honestly about structural racism with a patriotic lens. And this, there's, I don't know of any other book out there that's doing it in this way. Heather McGee's, I think, does it from an economic perspective, but this is from a character perspective. So please run out and buy the book, When the Stars Begin to Fall. The other thing I'm working on at the Brennan Center is projects around civic learning and civic engagement, and how we can create the kind of society that all of us want by investing more in civic learning beyond whether, you know, how many branches of government there are, but are we training people to be good citizens? Are we teaching them how to participate in democracy? I don't think we are. And so we're investigating ways to do that better.
Yeah, and I will just do a quick shout out. I am an Audible listener. I have the Audible version of the book. Ted, you did a very good job of narrating. So if people are into that, I also recommend they check that out as well too. Well, Ted, thank you so much for joining. This has been really great. I recommend the book to everyone. Thanks for coming on the show.
No, thank you for having me so much. I really appreciate it.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and most importantly, realignment conference signups. Not everyone who applies is going to be able to make it, but we'll definitely put stuff together in the future because we're getting so many awesome people who are reaching out. And of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.